This episode of Earl Grey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Denny. I played Lieutenant Commander Shelby on Star Trek Next Generation, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Theo Greyhawk.
Welcome to another cup of Earl Grey, Trek FM's dedicated podcast to the next generation. I'm your host, Justin Ozer, and join with me today are the multi-talented Amy Nelson and the versatile Richard Marquez. How are you doing today?
Wow, I am really liking these intros. Thank you very much. I'm doing great today.
And I was going to say, I had to throw in something a little different for this
very
one.
Nice.
And Richard, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, really well. Thank you for the compliment.
Glad to do it. When you guys host, you give compliments to me as well. So might as well send it along.
Right on.
All right. So we do have a very special episode for you today. But before we get into that, we have some feedback from the Babel Conference for episode 212. Which is Favorite Character Moments, Season 2. So, Richard, I think you want to read the first comment?
Sure. Christopher Littlefield said, loved it. It's really nice to get a deeper and analyze this series. We didn't really spend a lot of time doing that back then. And I'm assuming back then he's talking about
in the 80s.
Earl Grey 1.0 versus... Oh,
No, I think when he watched it in the 80s, yeah. Probably.
Oh, I guess. Okay, that makes more sense. Okay, I thought he was talking about the old Earl Grey crew versus us, but okay, that's fine. Okay, cool.
Yeah, no podcasts back in the 80s to endlessly dissect the episodes, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. Christopher Baca says, some really great picks. I really like Pen Pals, Elementary Dear Data, Q Who, In Measure of a Man, When Riker Shuts Down Data. That is a great scene. Absolutely couldn't agree more. Those are very good scenes and good episodes. Season 2 is just chock full of so many good moments.
It has a lot of great stuff, and he mentions Measure of a Man, which, of course, is widely considered the best one of the best episodes of Season 2 or the whole series, and we didn't even mention any moments. I think I might not have picked any because I thought you guys would pick some, or it's just... You know, more common
yeah,
choice.
Yeah, because it is. It's so well loved and everyone knows it. We like to highlight those that maybe some people have forgotten.
I actually stay away from those when we do those episodes because, like, I mean, obviously they're the more common ones and more liked ones. So that's why I always choose something outside of
yeah.
that. Usually. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I'll often do that just to make sure we're, you know, giving some credit to episodes people don't think about quite yeah. as much and get them to watch those. Well, we also got an email about that Favorite Character Moment Season 2 episode, and that came from Chris Smith in Oklahoma. And Chris says, Justin had mentioned if any listeners would like to continue hearing the character moments of math in the next generation. And my first thought was, me. Yes, I very much enjoyed the math commentary in Season 1 and Season 2 character moment shows. I love math myself, and I definitely cast my vote in for yes, please, Amy, continue finding those great math moments.
Well, I am so excited to get that email. It really made my day, and I will continue finding those math moments for sure now. So you guys are with it for the long haul.
What do you mean for sure?
For sure.
Well, but the pressure's on to find it in not only every season, but every movie, too.
So could we do like a bet or something like that if I find it first or you find it first, Justin?
What?
No, I'll leave it to to Amy to find those things. But
yeah,
yeah, I'm sure there must be something that you can use from every season.
I am sure. And challenge accepted. Not that it's going to be a hard challenge, because math is everywhere.
Sure. I mean, they're using lots of math and engineering to make the ship go. So,
well, some of it's nonsense too. So,
well, yeah, they're making it up, but I mean, some of it's based on.
I mean, it's basically techno babble to turn on and off the switch.
Yeah, but I like to believe it. I want
so
to
it was very interesting. We've got a lot of all of our mentions feedback were from Chris's. So thanks, Chris's out there.
Oh, goodness. I didn't even notice that. Every one of them was a Chris. Wow.
Yeah, it was going on when I did postcards. Like, there are so many Christophers on the Babel Conference, and we just love you all.
That's amazing. I didn't even think about that, but yeah. So people not named Chris, you can give us feedback on these episodes. It's okay.
Yes, please.
Okay, so well, thank you so much, listeners, for your feedback on our last episode. And now we do have something very special for you. It is an interview with Elizabeth Dennehy, who played Commander Shelby in The Best of Both Worlds. And we're going to take you right into that interview now. Today on Earl Grey, we have a very special guest, Elizabeth Dennehy, who played Commander Shelby in two of the most important episodes in all of Star Trek, The Best of Both Worlds, Parts 1 and 2. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, of course. My pleasure.
So I just wanted to start off by asking a couple of questions. So how did your acting career start? And did your father have anything to do with you becoming an actor?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. I always wanted to be an actor. As long as I can remember, when I was a kid, I was always performing and singing and dancing. And my dad, my parents had us when they were very young. So he was just trying to keep the family going, you know, doing odd jobs. He didn't become a professional actor until I was about 16. But, performing and seeing plays and acting was always a part of our lives. I mean, I can remember watching movies with him and him knowing every word to On the Waterfront. So for sure, it definitely was an influence. That it was a viable job, that it was considered a respectable profession. Definitely, he set an example that, you know, this was something that one could do. When he would go off in the summer and do summer stock, and he would do plays, I saw that was the way he worked, and none of my friends had that. Their fathers all had typical day jobs, working in offices. And some of them would actually say to me, your dad is so lucky, you know, with a kind of a wistful look in their eyes. And even though my dad wasn't around a whole lot, I thought we were lucky because he did what he loved. So yeah, he definitely was an influence, I would say. That he, even before he was doing it professionally, he was always acting in community theater, doing dinner theater. It was always a part of our lives, him growing up, for sure.
Excellent. Well, and I guess I should probably add, because I didn't say it specifically, that your father's Brian Dennehy, who was, I guess, already pretty well known as an actor when you were growing up, right?
Well, he was known, like, on Long Island, you know, where I grew up. He when I was in elementary school, we lived in a town called Amityville, Long Island. And it's pretty amazing when you think about it. A guy with three kids by the time he was 25, 26, who was just doing any job he could to keep a roof over our head and food on the table. He was a meat trucker. He was a security guard in a motel. He did, jobs here and there. He had a family before he had graduated from college. That he had such a desire that he created a community theater group in Amityville called the Amityville Community Theater. And he did plays at the Amityville High School. And so we were always being dragged into being like kids in Carousel. We were snow children. That was just our way of life for us. It wasn't until I was older that I realized that not everybody lived like this. Not everybody acted out musicals to the album playing in the house. But my sisters and I, we were obsessed. You know, we would act out the entire Man of La Mancha. We would act out Funny Girl. We acted out all of the musicals growing up, and that was just normal for us.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. My dad had Man of La Mancha on record, and there was me and my two sisters, and we would act it out too. That's so funny.
Yeah, we would torture our family and make them sit and listen to us playing the entire score on a kazoo of a musical.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. Yep, I would make my little brother sit down. Okay, you're going to watch us.
Exactly. Christ Superstar was a big one. We used to act that out. And so when we were little, you know, we were naturally always doing the shows. I can remember running home from school in the fourth grade because they were doing Midsummer Night's Dream, and I got cast as Helena, and the boy I had a crush on was Demetrius. So that was really, really young. It was just such a part of our lives growing up. I didn't think anything of it. I didn't think it was extraordinary until much later on. You know, and then when he was directing Funny Girl, I made him audition me for Fanny Brice because I was obsessed. And, you know, we were cast as little fairies in The Tempest. We were always being cast in the shows. I remember being an urchin, a street urchin in Streetcar Named Desire. And to grow up as a little kid and knowing huge passages of these plays, we were the no-neck monsters on Cat on the Hotchin Roof. We had no idea what the play was about. But that it was just what we did. That was what we did on the weekends. That was our team sport. Some families go to football games or, you know, rooting for the home team. This is what we did in our spare time growing up. And I didn't realize that, you know, we had no money and, you know, he probably shouldn't have been indulging in a hobby like this. But obviously he needed this. He needed to do this in order to live and be happy. You know, and so then so he was not famous until when I was 16, he did around about that time, they did these showcases in New York. And he started getting into the showcase scene in New York. He got cast as an understudy in Streamers, which was at Lincoln Center. I believe Mike Nichols directed it and went on. And then Mike Nichols recommended him for jobs here and there. And he got cast in Semi-Tough, which was a movie starring Burt Reynolds and Chris Christopherson about football. And he got cast in as like the crazy guy who dangles this girl from the roof of a house party, you know, total like Michael Penn, Jim Belushi, Vincent D'Onofrio kind of role, like the unhinged crazy guy. And after that, he never stopped working. So then it really still took a really long time for him to be a household name. He did the movie 10, where he was the bartender. People started really noticing him then. And I think around about after 10, he didn't have to audition for jobs anymore. He just got offers. But still, he was always like, that guy, you know that guy. Like, people don't know him by that name. His name, they know him as that guy, you know.
That big
guy. Because I still get people coming up to me thinking he's Charles Durning or Brian Keith. You know, it's pretty funny when people say, I thought your father died. And I'm like, no, you're thinking of Charles Durning or you're thinking of Brian Keith. Actors, no. I mean, actors, people who are in the theater, but people who, you know, sometimes I go to conventions and people don't know him by his name. You know, he's a character actor. That's very common for character actors.
Well, that's kind of interesting because I feel like I've known you know his name and his work for as long as I can remember. I mean, I'm fairly young, but I guess I didn't realize that it wasn't as much of you know a known name to necessarily a lot of like the general audience out there.
Yeah, that's kind of how it progresses. You know, it's like that old thing that they say, you know. You know, who's Brian Dennehy? Get me Brian Dennehy. Get me a Brian Dennehy type, and then who is Brian Dennehy? You know, that's kind of how the trajectory works. Because I have people come to me and say, I haven't seen him in a long time. What's he been doing? But he's never stopped working. He does a lot of theater. He loves theater. He mostly loves theater. So the last thing, you know, he does Blacklist. He's worked on, done a couple of episodes of Blacklist, but the last thing he did was Endgame at the Long Wharf Theater. with Reggie Cathy. So, I mean, he's always working. He's going to be 80 in July, you know?
Wow.
Cool. Right on.
Yeah. So he lives for work. He loves it.
That's great to be active at that, especially at that age.
Yeah. Awesome. It really keeps him going. He loves it.
Awesome. Well, hey, Elizabeth, this is Richard. So we have a group called the Babel Conference, and we actually had a couple people ask questions that they might want you to answer. So our first guy our first commenter is Tim Hans, and he asked, "Hi, Elizabeth, were you a fan of Star Trek or very familiar with Star Trek before you were offered the part for Commander Shelby? And how did you prepare for the character after you got it?"
Oh, that's a good question. I was not a fan of Star Trek. I'm going to make a big confession here. I went to an all-girl Catholic school, and truthfully, the people who were into sci-fi and Star Trek were kind of nerds. And now it's so amazing because you go to these Star Trek conventions and the people are all dressed up in costumes and stuff. And now it's like kind of cool. Cosplay is kind of cool. But back in like the 70s, people who were into Star Trek were kind of like, you know, the nerds and the geeks. And I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be, you know, cool. So no, I was really into English stuff like Shakespeare and Upstairs, Downstairs and the Six mm-hmm. Wives of Henry VIII. I was a real Anglophile, and I loved stuff like that. But sci-fi, I don't know, it never interested me. So funnily enough, when I went to the audition, I had just moved to California, just moved to LA. I was 28, and I never wanted to move to LA because I was a serious actress. I didn't want to do sitcoms or, you know, TV, you know, typical theater snob. And moved to LA, and it was just an audition. It was just a job. And when I got the part, I was like, okay, whatever. And I remember when I first started working, Jonathan Frakes said to me, "You have no idea what this is, do you?" And I was like, "No, I don't. I didn't know who Riker was. I didn't know anything about. And I think that was a really good thing, because I think I would have been too nervous had I known, if I knew, you know, that I was going to be being interviewed, you know, 30 years later. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. I can't think of another franchise in existence where you have that kind of interest and legacy. So no, I had no idea. And in preparation for it, I think, remember, this is like back in 91. So there's no internet. There were no computers. There was no question of watching old shows. And I didn't know that this was the first time Riker's authority had ever been challenged. But I think that was a good thing. I think it was good that I wasn't prepared, that I was this hotshot coming in and telling everybody how wrong they were and how stupid they were. Had I known, I think I would have been too nervous.
Well, that's interesting you talk about that, because one of the questions was, let's see. Oh, Michael Gillum Peckett says, "Did you ever receive any hate mail or criticism because that you were mean to Riker? I mean, was there any backlash from that?"
This is a great question. What's so interesting about this is how much things have changed since then. Back in the day, when I was 28, 30 years ago, people were like, "Oh, you were such a bitch. I hated you." I never got hate mail, but people were like, "You know, you were really, I didn't like the way you talked to them, but you were right. You were right. You knew your stuff." Very resentful. They would give Shelby the credit, but they didn't like my manner. Now, think about how much has changed about women being able to be bosses and be smart and tell people what they're doing wrong. Now I get nothing but mad respect. It's really amazing how much has changed in 30 years. I looked at Shelby like she was a straight A student. She was the kid in the class with her arm up going, "Ooh, ooh, ooh, pick me. I know the answer. And they're annoying, but yet you've got to applaud the fact that they care and they're so zealous and that they those people really are so passionate about what they know and their knowledge. And now everything has totally changed. You know, everybody's telling people you need to applaud women and let them be the bosses and let them lead the way and give them respect. So a lot, when I go to conventions now, completely different. People like, yeah, you tell them you really knew what you were doing. It's really amazing how it's changed. Everybody's become a feminist.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting also because for me, I've become a Star Trek fan more recently. So I first, saw The Next Generation and those episodes probably, 7 or 8 years ago, something like that. And the first time I saw it and I saw Shelby, I was like, what is this that's going on? You know, we have this crew that we love and we love Riker and what he does. And who is this person that's challenging him? And it took me kind of rewatching it to really have more respect for that and understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And now when I rewatch it, I really kind of appreciate where she's coming from. And it's like, there's this really urgent situation going on,
mm-hmm.
and she has the expertise and it's needed to resolve the situation and get a lot further than they could without Shelby. So I feel like her attitude is necessary because she's impatient to get it done because their whole existence is at stake, right?
Yeah, and all of this like proper protocol and, you know, waiting and seeing and all of this stuff, there's an emergency and there's no time for that. Now, here's something else that I don't know if people really have taken in, but it's very important to consider. When we were acting the first part, we had never seen the second part. We had no idea what was going to happen.
Yeah, I think it hadn't even been written yet.
Even been written yet. And so when we were doing the first part, you had to kind of plant the seed for every and any possible eventuality. So for instance, I remember Jonathan saying to me, we should play in the scene. When I say, you're in my way, you're in my way. We had to play that. He said to me, we should pick a scene where there's a little heat between us, where there is a potential for a relationship. And I was like, oh yeah, I bet you say that to all the girls. But he was like, no, seriously, we don't know if they're going to fall in love in the second episode, or are we going to kill each other? We have no idea. So you kind of have to play everything all at the same time so that it doesn't come out of nowhere what happens in the second episode.
Oh my
gosh,
that's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, think about it. We had no idea what was going to happen, if they were going to go run off and be in love and fall in, or are we going to murder each other? Are we going to kill each other? We had no idea what was going to happen. So you kind of have to, it reminded me when I was on The Guiding Light, it was the same thing. You know, I'd be fighting with this guy and it would be like, but you had to play that maybe there was underneath the fighting a little bit of an attraction that you didn't want to have, because the next week you'd be in bed together. You have
right.
to play all these different things. And, you know, you pick a line here and there where you look at each other and you feel something. So you have to plant the seed for every kind of possible eventuality when you don't have the script. If I knew what the second part was going to be, it would have changed how the whole first part went, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had no idea. We had no idea what was going to happen.
Yeah, and actually, I think I have a couple of questions related to that because, you know, there's been a lot of, interest and discussion about that because, you know, leaving off at that first part, it's considered, probably still considered the best cliffhanger in Star Trek history, if not, you know, TV history, with kind of leaving it open, like, is Riker going to kill Picard? What's this show going to be? What's going to happen, right?
Right.
And so there was that first part that was written and that you had filmed. The second part hadn't been written yet. And the first part aired. And I think there was all of this anticipation for months in the Star Trek community. And my first question is, were you aware of that anticipation that people had for the second part?
I was in the summertime. I was after the first part aired. And everywhere I went, people were like, what happens? I mean, I was recognized and, you know, I'd never been involved with something where we are sending you pages, but they are top secret, and burn them after you read them, and all of that kind of stuff. And Jonathan, you know, I learned a lot from the first episode that Jonathan and Michael and everybody would tell me that, you know, you sign all these things and you have to keep this top secret. And they were like, you have no idea, this is going to blow up. And they warned me, they said, you are going to be a villainess, because nobody has ever questioned the authority of Riker or his first officer ever before. Now, there's also, aside from the whole story part, I think I can say this, that there's this whole other theory that their contracts were up and they were trying to show the cast that, you know, you don't sign your contract, you don't come back, we can always replace you. We can just move on with somebody else. But the story is so well written, I don't know about that. I don't think that's the reason why the script was written. I think it was a great idea after the show had been running for a few seasons to have a cliffhanger, shake things up a little bit. But there is that theory out there. And then everybody signed it, so it was all wrapped up in the second episode. I actually don't think I was very good when I watched the show. I can see my actor nervousness. I mean, it really was like the first job I had after I got to Hollywood. But I mean, I was really young. I mean, I was 8 years older than my oldest son, which blows my mind. It really just freaks me out.
It's interesting that you say that, because I had a chance to rewatch those episodes just a couple of days ago. And I mean, I think you do give a really great performance. And if there's any nervousness that shows, you can see that as, you know, Shelby having a little nervousness, being in this position, pushing and trying to, you know,
yeah, it reads get into what, the what character. She wants.
Yeah. Can you tell, you won't be able to tell, the first scene that was shot, my first scene that was shot, it doesn't go in order all the time. The first scene we shot was, it's in, it's so long ago, so I don't know what the room is. The ready room, maybe? And everybody's there. And I have this speech. Projections suggest that a Borg ship like this one could continue to function effectively, even if 78% of it were rendered inoperable.
Yes.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think that's in the observation lounge, which is where
they
meet.
That was my very first scene. And I know that because that line was so hard for me to learn. That line, I will never forget that line because it's taken up so much real estate in my brain. It was so hard to learn that stuff. So hard to learn.
You had to do a lot of technical terminology, which we like to call technobabble, and you certainly had your fair share of it. How was it preparing for those type of lines and not even knowing anything about Star Trek?
Because I didn't know anything about Star Trek or this world, I tell the story a lot at conventions. I'll never forget the lines because it was like learning the times tables. But I got to say, if you think about it, if you really think about separate the saucer section, assign a skeleton crew to create a diversion, it actually makes logical sense. So I had to paint the picture in my head of what it was I was talking about. Separate the saucer section. Push that away. Assign a skeleton crew to create a diversion makes logical sense. So the picture in my head helped me remember the words. Then when I went on to do another sci-fi show where I played an elder wearing white robes, I had to also say things like that actually made no sense. And I remember asking a question. I said, why am I asking you, this is the show Charmed. I asked this guy, all these questions, and I'm saying, but I'm supposed to be omniscient and omnipresent. Why am I asking him questions if I know everything? And they were like, oh, don't ask questions like that on this show. So Star Trek, they have all the answers. It actually does make logical sense. And so there's where, you know, Gene Roddenberry and all the people that worked on that show were, you know, amazing, because it really was a world that could exist. If you have the science.
Yeah.
So pretty amazing. That's how you learn lines. I teach kids now. I teach Shakespeare at a high school in LA, and I use that line, separate the saucer section, assign a skeleton crew to create a diversion, as a vocal exercise, because that line also, I will never forget. It will be emblazoned on my tombstone because it was so hard to learn. But it's like learning the times tables. You just have to drill it. You have to say it over and over and over again. It's mouth and vocal gymnastics. And you literally have to train your mouth to go this way, that way, this way, that way. So the preparation can be about the acting and the intention, like what is it I'm trying to achieve here? But it also has to be muscle memory too, a part of it. I don't know how Brett and LeVar did it. I do not know how they did it. You know what was the hardest scene for me? Was the poker scene, because I do not have a clue about cards. Cards mystify me. I just went and saw Molly's game and I was like, I don't know what they're talking about. I had to really act in that scene, make it look like I knew what I was doing. And I was supposed to be a poker whiz, and I can't even play Old Maid. I don't get it. I just don't get it at all.
That's interesting, because I mean, I think the scene is very convincing, and actually I think it's the first time that we see Riker bested by anybody at poker. So it's meant to emphasize that you're kind of on Shelby's on her way up and, you know, can best Riker even in these kinds of games, right?
Well, you watch it again, you'll know I have no idea what I did to win, how I won, why I won. I have no idea. No clue.
Wow. That's something.
You sold that. You sold that scene. I actually replaying that whole entire episode, or that scene in my head. I was like, you sold that to me.
That's good.
That's amazing. Now I know.
That is so good. Yeah, that's great. That's great to hear. That's a huge compliment, because I really didn't know. But Jonathan and I talked a lot about the tone. Like, she is innocent. She's like, oh, we're playing poker. Of course I'm going to try my best. Of course I'm going to win. You know, not thinking that there's anything wrong or sinister with anything that, you know, Shelby was doing. Just, you know, just trying to be the best all the time. Always being at her best. So that and eating nothing but fruit for the 2 weeks of shooting was really, really challenging. People would ask me out to dinner. I was like, no, I cannot. I can't. Those jumpsuits are really unforgiving.
Wow. Yeah, we've heard some stories.
Yeah.
So I have another question from our Facebook listeners group, the Babel Conference.
Okay.
So this was a question that several people had asked a variation of. So Zach Marr asked, were there any talks of you returning to Star Trek as Shelby? Did you have any ideas where you'd like to take the character in a return appearance?
Nobody ever said anything to me. So no, it was never discussed. I actually went back and auditioned for, oh God, it was so long ago. What was the one? I think it was Kate Mulgrew got the part.
Okay, for Voyager.
Oh, for Voyager.
Oh, yes.
Oh, so you auditioned for Captain Janeway on Voyager?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what was that experience like compared
to auditioning
for Shelby?
Well, at first, I remember this. I remember thinking, seriously, do I have to audition? But I, you know, it's just another job. It's just another thing you go through. I didn't think anything of it. You know, I remember I was really young and really inexperienced. So I had a lot to prove.
Yeah, because I think we've even speculated on this show, like what would have, because I think part of the reason that the cliffhanger was really compelling for the episode was that there were rumors actually that Patrick Stewart wanted out of the show.
Oh.
And that might mean in the second part that when Riker fires, he actually, you know, kills Picard in some way. And that would have meant that, you know, Riker would be the captain, Shelby might be the first officer. And we've just speculated what that would be like if the show went on like that.
Yeah.
Instead of what it was like before with Picard as the captain. I mean, if they had gone that way and that would have happened, I mean, is that something you've thought about, or that you would have been interested in continuing that direction?
Yeah, I would have loved that. I would have loved that. You know, I just happy to work, you know, really happy to work. So yeah, I would have definitely considered it. I'm thinking, trying to put my myself back into my 28-year-old brain, theater snob brain. But I think that my agents would have been like, you absolutely have to do this, you know?
Yeah. Well, you've mentioned quite a bit talking with Jonathan Frakes and stuff. So was the cast like really tight knit? They say they were at conventions and stuff. And like, how was it going into, you know, by then they had been 3 years together. How was it going in and walking into a cast that was so tight knit?
Oh, they were just wonderful. They were all wonderful. I love them all. Jonathan had worked with my dad. Remember, I was talking about their showcases and stuff. They had mm-hmm. done plays together in the early days. And so he knew my dad, and Patrick and I had friends in common, and it was just lovely. They were wonderful. I remember, I think it was the first day of shooting, they all took me to Nick Adele's, which doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately, at the Gates of Paramount. It was like a real old school restaurant where they make a Caesar salad at your table, and pictures of those big eyed orphans on the wall, and really old school. And they just were, could not have been nicer. And then I see them from time to time at the conventions, and we all were at the premiere of Blunt Talk, the show that Patrick Stewart did.
Oh, uh-huh.
I have a really funny story about that party, if you wouldn't mind indulging
please
me.
Please share.
Oh, please. Yeah, please, please do.
Okay. So I am friends with Adrian Scarborough, who played Patrick Stewart's butler in Blunt Talk. And we were invited to the premiere of that. And Seth MacFarlane was the producer. I had never met him before. And he got up on stage and he talked about, before the show started, the pilot, he talked about how much he loved Star Trek and how much he loved Patrick Stewart, and he wanted to work with him, and been trying to come up with a project for them to work together before. And he was like, you know, said he was a total next gen geek, knew all the words, blah, blah, blah. And Marina was there and everybody was there. We're all there to support Patrick. So at the party afterwards, which was at the Chateau Marmont, I'm with my sons, who are, one's an actor and one's a filmmaker. So they are like, their eyes wide open. You know, they're so happy to be there. I dragged them over to Seth MacFarlane, who had never met before. And I said, so you're a big Star Trek Next Gen fan? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, I'm Lieutenant Commander Shelby. And he looked at me and he went, that means you're Elizabeth Dennehy. I suppose that's why someone like you sits in the shadow of a great man, passing off one command after he started saying all of my lines to me. And we started doing all of our scenes and lines. Isn't that hilarious?
Oh, my
God. And my kids were standing there like, oh, my God. They couldn't believe it happened. Now, that was really nervy of me, because he could have looked at me like, yeah, whatever. But he started doing every single line by line. He knew my lines better than I did.
Oh, my gosh.
That's so cool. Amazing.
That was really, really funny. That was
a great
night.
Do you watch The Orville? Because Seth has that new show, The Orville, out.
I haven't. I'm so bad. I don't watch any TV. I'm really, really bad. We pop in DVDs and we watch movies, but I watch Project Runway and The Voice. I'm so lame. I have to watch The Orville. Everybody keeps telling me. I'll tell you the reason TV is so good right now, and there's so many good shows, and I'm such a OCD person that I know I would never leave my house if I started. Mm-hmm. I've never seen Mad Men or Homeland or Network or Handmaid's Tale or any of those great shows everybody raves about, because I would never do anything else.
Yeah.
And I have too much other stuff that I have to do.
Agreed.
So,
I have to ask you something related, though. So, I mean, you had said when you got the part of Shelby for The Next Generation, you had never seen Star Trek. I'm just curious, after that experience, if you had gone back and watched any Star Trek after that.
No. No.
It's okay if the answer is no. I was just curious if it had spurred you to do that.
I mean, I am really good friends with Colin Meaney and Rosalind Chow. Actually, I think we're going to go to London and see Rosalind's doing a show at the National Theater in London. And so I would watch, you know, them, but no, I didn't. I'm really lame when it comes to TV. If I don't TiVo it, I'm actually the dialogue coach on The Middle. I run lines with the actors to make sure they know their lines. And I had never seen an episode. I had never seen an episode before I started working on it. So I started TiVoing it and watch it now, but I'm just, I don't know. TV is just, it's, there's, I was on the SAG nominating committee for TV this year. And so we had to select the people who were going to be nominated. And it was like a phone book. Because every actor in a TV series, limited series or long running, cable, everything, there must have been 800 names for each category. I mean, it's each impossible. Category? You can't watch all the good TV that's on now.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
You know, I teach high school Shakespeare, and between my job on the middle and then on the weekends, I have private students. I just don't have time.
Yeah. That's okay. So, you have a life. That's good.
Perfectly fine. We just got both our kids are now in college. We are empty nesters for the first time ever this year. So that's a huge, huge achievement. And maybe now I'll be able to sit down and enjoy a TV show. But it's been full, you know, when you're a parent, it's like a full-time job.
Yeah, tell me about it. I know exactly what you mean. I actually have a 7-year-old daughter. So one of the things I've been doing is I've been introducing her to Star Trek. And before this interview, I actually had her sat her down and watched Best of Both Worlds, Part 1 and 2. And, you know, from front to end. So I asked her, and this will be a part of the question. I asked her, what did you think about, I don't know if she knew your name. I think I said Commander Shelby first, and she didn't understand what I was talking about. And then I was like, this woman right here. And I paused the writer. I was like, what did you think of her? He's like, I really like her.
Oh, that's so nice.
She absolutely loves, how you are, I guess aggressive, and whatnot in your act. And my question is that, do you think, or I'm sorry, not my question. I'm sorry. This is from a Baylor conference listener. Do you think Commander Shelby is a good role model for girls and women?
Absolutely. I think so because she has a lot of knowledge. She's a specialist. I do think that, you know, diplomacy is a really important skill. And to not railroad over people, you know, steamroll over people with your ideas is maybe not the best way to get your ideas implemented. So I think a little bit of both. She's a really good role model because she's so skilled and educated. And if people aren't going to respect you and listen to you and you have no choice, then absolutely. You've got to do what you need to do to save lives. But I also think that working with people and, you know, being diplomatic and maybe not so aggressive, it all depends on the state of the emergency. I mean, when, you know, we went back to on the Borg ship to rescue Patrick, you do what you need to do. This is a life and death situation. You know, and ultimately it was Riker that made the decision to fire on the ship. I don't know what Shelby would have done. I think we got ourselves in a situation where there was nothing else to be done. Yeah, I think she's a good role model. Right. And to, you know, speak up when you know your stuff. You know, you got to really speak up. That's what they hired you to do. You got to do the job you were hired to do and not pussyfoot around. And like I said, times have changed a lot. You know, get the job done. Get the job done. I'm not there to make friends.
I love it. I love it. Thank you.
So you had mentioned, and since I live here in Las Vegas, that you have been to some conventions. So I want to know, when are you coming back to Star Trek Las Vegas, and how is it going to the conventions?
I love them. My very first one was right after, I guess, the show had aired. I'm trying to remember it must have been after both parts had aired. And it was in St. Louis, Missouri, and I was with George Takei, who is just a hoot. He's so adorable. We had a great time. I was really, really nervous. I was really scared that because I wasn't, you know, a sci-fi fan, that people were going to think that I was a imposter. But people are so nice. you know, I had been told that people don't know that this is a job. They really believe, you know, people will ask you questions like, what was your Fraser frequency set to when you shot the Borgs? And I'm like, dude, it was a plastic TV remote, as far as I was concerned. You know, there are people who believe that it's actually happening in real life. And mm-hmm. so I was a little bit freaked out. I'd been scared, but people haven't been that way. They've been lovely, really, really nice, and genuine and welcoming. And I love going to the conventions. Yeah, I've never had a bad experience. I have to be asked back. So you get on them.
I will. I'm on
Vegas,
it.
Vegas is, you know, it's Vegas. It's really a trip. But you know, we make an excuse for a family vacation. We all go together and we all have fun. I remember my boys were just permitted drivers the last one I went to. So I made them do all the driving the last time we went to Vegas. And yeah, so if you can do that drive, you can do anything.
That's right.
So yeah, I know, I love doing the conventions. Yeah.
Okay. I'm emailing creation right now.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, they're really fun. And it's fun to have a reunion when you see all your old friends. I think there was one time when Michael Dorn and Jonathan Frakes were on stage and I snuck up behind them. They didn't know I was there. And, you know, you get to see them all again, catch up. It's fun. Yeah. Really fun. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to be going into New York. My husband is Irish, and he and Colm Meaney knew each other when they were kids. They've known each other really,
really,
really a long time. Yeah, they've been dear, dear friends since they were teenagers. And so Colm is doing Iceman Cometh with Denzel Washington in New York. So we'll be going in to see that and going to see Roz. And it's a great life.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So I had another question from our listeners group.
Okay.
So, and I know you may have been asked this before, but I'm just curious your thoughts on this. So, Ruby Elizabeth asks, are you aware of Shelby's continued/expanded role in the novel, such as the New Frontier series? And if so, what are your thoughts on how the various authors have developed her character?
I haven't been reading them.
But I think I saw in another interview, you were aware that she ends up becoming a captain, then an admiral, right?
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah.
Good.
Which is great, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She has an important role in those. I've read some of them. They're actually really excellent, but I think
good.
People really enjoy them and we're just curious about it.
Yeah.
But of course, if you don't have time for a lot of TV shows.
I don't have time. No, I barely have time to read the books I need to read. Yeah, no, sorry. I haven't been keeping up, but it sounds like a great idea.
Well, we have another question. Michael Poteet is wondering, which of your many non-Star Trek roles are you proudest of and why?
Oh, non-Star Trek. Gosh, I would have to say, because I theater or on film, my favorite film job ever was a TV pilot I shot for TNT with Robert Urich called Lazarus Man. Hmm. And I don't even know if it exists anymore because I've actually tried to find the DVD. It was a TV show that was way ahead of its time. You know who was also on it? It was Natalia Nogaluch. She was on
yes.
it.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and yeah. It was a brilliant idea. So this man wakes up and he's buried alive out in the wild, wild west. He has no idea who he is. He has no idea how he got there. Robert Urich played the part. He's discovered by my son, and we take him in and we nurse him back to health. Turns out he was one of Abraham Lincoln's Secret Service guys.
Oh, goodness.
And he spends the whole series. So it's sort of sci-fi, but historical. And he spends mm-hmm. the whole series trying to piece together the story of what happened and how he got out there. And we shot it in Santa Fe. And I got to wear beautiful costumes and had a long wig and I got to shoot a gun and drive a buckboard, a horse and buggy. It was so much fun. And Santa Fe was so beautiful. And Robert Urich was so lovely to work with. I loved that job. I was really, really proud of that. And then theater, there's a couple of things. South Coast Rep is a theater down in Orange County here, and I did Streetcar Named Desire and played Stella. And that was really fun. I loved that show. That was great. And also, I did Dancing at Lunasa there with my husband.
Nice.
And that was great. So those jobs have been wonderful. I love those jobs.
Nice.
So I'm curious, outside of acting, what other, you know, hobbies and interests that you have?
So for years, I was always the person that friends would call when they had an audition, and they would come over and I would work with them. I'm a really good audition coach. And so my son, who's now 20, when he auditioned for LOXA, the Los Angeles County High School for the Arts, I was being called by friends, would I work with their kids? And now I've started this, like, I do this every weekend, audition coaching for kids who are auditioning for colleges. You know, it's the contrasting monologue, Shakespeare monologue, and then finding the monologues and then working up a really great audition. So I do that a lot, and I really love doing that. I love working with young people. And then after I started working on The Middle as a dialogue coach, I was asked to teach the Shakespeare class at LOXA. So I do that now. So I literally go from The Middle on Mondays and Wednesdays. I drive to LOXA, teach my Shakespeare class, which involves participating in Shakespeare festivals in Southern California. And we put on an evening of Shakespeare scenes at the end of March. So it's a lot of work, and I love it. So between audition coaching and The Middle and doing that, I have very little time left over. But we love to travel. We go to Europe every summer. My husband's mom still lives in Ireland. We go at New York Christmas time, see my family. My father lives in Connecticut. So we travel whenever we can. You know, my spring break is the end of March. We're going to go see Roz. We're going to go see Colm. You know, all of that stuff. So traveling is... I live for traveling, and I get to go see my son in Chicago. He's doing a play, Native Son, at DePaul school show. He's a junior, and it's his first main stage show. So all of that keeps us very, very busy.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, I mean, it's a lot of great stuff that you enjoy, right?
So yeah, that's good. And we go to the theater. I probably see 2 or 3 plays a week.
Oh, wow.
Wow, that's busy.
Yeah, we go to a theater a lot. Like Antius, you know, the company that Armin Shimmerman works at, I've worked there, and Kitty Swink. And so I saw Hot House on Tuesday night, and I just went down to South Coast last night and saw Shakespeare in Love with Bill Brochtrup was in it, and Stephen Caffrey, and lots of really good friends, many of whom have been on Star Trek.
Nice.
Yes, I'm recognizing some more names.
Yeah, I don't know if Bo Foxworth has done it, but Linda Park, Daniel Beth, all of those people, they're all, you know, Antians. And we, if you go see them in shows, you're never going to be disappointed.
I love Linda Park.
Oh, my God. They did Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with Daniel as Brick, and she was Maggie the Cat. It was sensational. Dawn.
That makes me want to go see it.
Don Didowick and Harry Groner were in that too. So lots of great theater out there that, you know, once theater goes away, it's gone. So you don't want to miss it.
Got to experience it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So tell us about any current or upcoming work you'd like to let our listeners know about.
Nothing really, you know, I'm just trying to get through the end of March when The Middle ends, the final season, and all the auditions will be over, and I get to sleep until I wake up. That is a luxury I never get, because I'm up at 5 o'clock most mornings, and when all that's done, then I will think about the next step. But I'm open to all offers, and hopefully get back on stage again.
Nice.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Oh, it's a pretty boring life, but it's very, very busy.
No, it sounds great.
Well, it sounds like you're doing what you love and you're passionate about it. So there's no boredom there.
No. And I'm applying to a summer course at the Globe in London for teaching Shakespeare. So I'm really hoping that I get that. I think that would be really fun. And Mark Rylance is doing Othello there this summer. So spending a lot of time in London, hopefully. That's my plan.
Very nice.
Good vibes.
Yeah, we're sending good thoughts that that comes through.
Yeah, yeah. Me too. Thanks so much.
Just doing it at the Globe. Wow.
Yeah, it would be great. Yeah.
So where can listeners find you online?
Oh my gosh. I don't have anything. I'm so sorry. I don't even have a
You're
website.
On Twitter, right?
Yeah, but I'm really lame. I'm really lame. I am like, I had to make a resume and I really don't even know how to do that. I'm lame on Twitter. You know,
well, that's where I found you. So it's not so lame. You responded to me on Twitter.
So sweet. That's so great. You're really nice. Yeah, I have it just kind of to keep my eye on what's going on. Got to keep our eyes on what's going on.
Well, okay. So if listeners are interested, they can go to Twitter
they
and search
your name.
They can find
me on Twitter. Yeah.
They should be able to find you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being on Earl Grey today. We really
appreciate
it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Nice talking
really
to you.
Really was a pleasure. Okay. I'm very excited, and I'm going to push to get you back to Star Trek Las Vegas. It's my
yes,
goal.
More conventions. Yes. More conventions would be great. Terrific.
Excellent.
All right. Thank you.
Well, it's been so amazing talking with Commander Shelby herself, Elizabeth Dennehy, but that isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. Here's what you might have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Ready Room.
There's no one else in the scene. And Marino was talking, it's like, we couldn't even get like 5 or 6 extras. They were siphoning all of our extras money was going to DS9 to put more aliens on the promenade. Now,
yeah, all those extras were hanging out at Quark's.
That's right.
Because they knew, don't go to a Hutch Hutchinson party.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
When I was a projectionist, I literally had a masking taped X on the bottom of my seat. And then when the seats were taken out and replaced with, you know, new and improved seats, I was like, can I get that seat right there? So I do now have that seat in my living room right over there.
You live with a very patient woman, Mike.
Warp 5.
So I'm guessing that a lot of the interactions were probably about 50% fact and 50% dramatic license. So
okay, hold on a second. Are you telling me Hollywood's not reliable? You telling me I can't believe Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter is not real?
Brandon.
Really, that's where we go?
Brandon, we need to have a talk right now.
Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
So that idea of nostalgia is very much describing people in the same situation as the Voyager crew. You know, they're far away from home, they're wanting to get home. It's that kind of homesick longing. But maybe that's one reason that we see this kind of transition from in the early seasons, this nostalgia for this kind of idealized Earth that may or may not really exist anymore, to in the later seasons, the nostalgia is for the journey itself.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. That helps other listeners find our show.
If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up.
If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Earl Grey. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at trekfm and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. So, Richard, where can people contact you when you're not deciding... Whether to kill Picard.
The death of Picard sounds enticing. No. Well, they could find me on Facebook. I pop on here and there in the Babel Conference. And I am also on Twitter, and my handle is Eric's Ransom. Justin, where can people contact you when you're not fighting the Borg?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at TrekFan4747, where I tweet about nothing but Star Trek. Currently tweeting out my Season 4 rewatch of The Next Generation. And you can also find me hanging around the Babel Conference on Facebook. And Amy, where can people find you when you're not serving as Riker's first officer?
Well, you can find me here on the network doing Postcards from the Edge. That's our fan response mailbag show for the Star Trek Discovery. And you can find me on Twitter at Miss Amy Nelson. But my favorite place is right there in the Babel Conference.
If you'd like to keep, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. Available through our special Patreon patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And we would like to take this opportunity to recognize our current associate producers, Norman Lau, the amazing Justin Ozer, and Michael Huter. Thank you for everything and all your support for Trek FM and, of course, Earl Grey.
So join us next time for another cup of Earl Grey.
Today is a good day to die!
Great joy and gratitude.
If you can't make the big decisions, Commander, I suggest you make room for someone who can.